Ryan is one of our physical therapists, recently out of the Baseball USA campus and more recently in the Southeast market, out in the Pearland area. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to Ryan so you guys can get me off the mic, and I'll turn it over to him for the next 30 minutes.
Good morning. You guys hear me? Sounds like it. Thanks for the opportunity to come out here and talk to you guys. My name is Ryan Collins. I'm a physical therapist out in Pearland. I get the opportunity to work with those athletes out there and also with James Wilson. You guys know him as Bubba. So what I get to do today is talk to you guys about the squat, how I would and how I go about using it in rehab. Not to say that there's not other exercises out there, but we're going to kind of focus on the squat today to get us through that rehab to performance phase. So whenever I'm working with my athletes out there, first questions I'll typically ask them is, what do you want to achieve when you're here? Whether it's an injury, a small injury, if it's a big injury, a big surgery. A lot of them tell me, I want to run faster and jump higher, right? What athletes shouldn't be able to do that? And so what we are going to do today is we're going to kind of steal a concept from technology and use the concept called reverse engineering. So what we're going to do is, reverse engineering is the process of recreating and enhancing a design by disassembling and analyzing the final product. So if we look at what elite sprinters and jumpers can do, break down those characteristics, put them back into a program, hopefully from the beginning to the end, we can instill those characteristics into our athletes. So what separates the elite athletes? High power development, right? That's one of the first ones. High power is associated with high levels of sprinting, jumping, and changing direction. High levels of rate of force development, right? That separates the higher athletes whenever you break down sub-elite and elite groups. And then lastly, strength. Typically, if you match athletes for ability, the stronger athlete will win. So those are going to be the big characteristics we focus on. So looking at sprint performance, we can see that strength is specific, right? What they tell us is horizontal and vertical forces increase with increased running speeds, but the forces that are horizontal are steadily increasing while the vertical forces kind of stay the same. Two studies show that large increases in squat strength are required to just produce a small amount of sprinting increase ability, and then two studies show that things like resisted sprinting can be as effective or more effective than sprinting alone. Looking at the kind of the overall concept, the greater ability to orient the force onto the ground seems to be more important to sprint performance than the amount of force or total amount of force they're able to produce. And then looking at jumping performance, we can kind of see that when you think about a jump, it's going to be a vertical direction, so the squat's going to carry over pretty well. So you see when somebody compares the jumps, the front squat to a hip thrust exercise, you're going to see a greater increase in the jumping performance by the axial loaded exercise compared to the horizontal loaded exercise, the muscle groups that are being stressed. Sagittal plane movements compared to frontal plane movements improve jumping performance better. And then same thing with vertical jumps, horizontal jumps, the plyometrics, you're going to see a greater increase in jumping performance. So putting it all together, how are we going to apply those forces into our program? How do they apply the forces whenever they're performing these activities? Orienting those vertical and horizontal force vectors optimally improves the jumping and sprinting performances of those athletes. Accelerating with high velocity concentric forces and decelerating with low velocity eccentric forces. And then lastly, the muscle groups we're going to focus on, hip flexors, extensors, knee flexors, extensors, and the ankle plantar flexors. So how are we going to implement those? We're going to program these with the squat today. So like, you guys know a whole bunch of variations. We'll kind of talk about the ones I like to use. If you have any questions about ones you guys have come across or things that you've used in the past, we can talk about those as well. So phase potentiation. This is where the training adaptation stimulated by one period of training serves as a foundation for the development of certain fitness adaptations for the subsequent phase. So if you write down a program template, ideally each phase is building on to the next one. So if we look at early rehab, we're going to move into developing the activation to allow someone to move functionally. That functional movement can build on hypertrophy, strength, rate of force development, power, and then eventually performance. So that's kind of the template we're going to follow today. I don't need to spend a lot of time on the early rehab part. Hopefully all of us have been through that. Ideally, we should understand that squatting, right, the prime mover for squat is the quad. You're going to have some accessory muscles, but time spent in the early rehab phase should be focusing on getting that quad to reactivate. And if we have post-op precautions or pain, it's going to limit our ability to perform a lot of the exercises. So what we can use is EMG studies. We can use information to tell us how to train those muscles the best way to get that activation to improve. So what we know is that the quad has a mixed proportion of type 1 and type 2 fibers, so you're going to get a high velocity contraction as well as some duration and some fatigue. Each way is going to help stimulate the quad. The vastus lateralis and iliacus display superior activity in the ranges of 10 to 60 degrees, as well as getting down to 80 and 90. So knowing that we can just move through 60 degrees and still get a good contraction of those muscles allows us to minimize the depth of squat, or think that we can only squat to full depth. We can use those ranges to help that quad turn on. So looking at a program, the wall squat has been shown at 50 to 70% of the usual training speed, so slower, it's going to actually produce a superior vastus medialis to that vastus lateralis muscle activity, so 1.5%, I'm sorry, 1 times the amount. So if we slow down that activation, the vastus medialis is actually shown to increase its activity over the vastus lateralis. Single leg press produces superior vastus lateralis and medialis activity compared to the open chain knee extension. All right, so we're moving on. We have the person turning on their muscles, so now we're going to try and get functional with them. Big components of a functional squat we need to pay attention to. Ankle mobility, right? The study by Hemrick showed that there's a 38.5 degree necessity of ankle dorsiflexion to keep the heels down during a full squat. I got to mention, I changed up my slides, but I gave you guys all kinds of different notes, so I didn't want to go and give you a whole bunch of words on the slides, so I kind of trimmed it down, so you guys have all the notes with big amounts of information on there. I kind of trimmed it down, so I apologize for that. So bear with me, sorry. ACL force, so when we increase our heel lift, right, ACL forces are increased at the bottom of the squat, which is something that we want to make sure we don't bother with when we're dealing with rehab. And then finally, those with medial knee displacement have been found to have a lack of 20% of dorsiflexion and motion. Hip mobility is really important. All right, Hemrick's study showed that a different squatting test, there was a difference between 95 degrees with the standard deviation of 27 degrees above and below, so showing variations in the amount of hip mobility in the different squatting tasks. So we want to make sure that we can make those hips mobile as we're preparing for that functional motion. And then finally, trunk control. We know that the lumbar spine tolerates compressive forces better than shearing forces, and so as we see an increase in lumbar flexion during the squat, we want to make sure that that's something we want to avoid allowing to occur, those stresses as the lumbar flexion increases, it gets passed on to the passive structures, which is not what we're trying to stimulate in that address. Common faults, right? We talked about those, lack of anterior translation with the knee, improper weight shift, excessive forward trunk lean, and then knees flexing first. So some of the common things you guys see whenever you're trying to reestablish a squatting pattern with your athletes, with your patients. So some cues we can use, moving the knees towards the toes to get the ankle mobility, keeping the chest over the feet to maintain a good center mass over the base support, keeping the trunk upright, so the eyes and chest upright, and then getting the hips to go back. A lot of times when you have somebody who flexes their knees first, you're going to lock out your ankles pretty quickly, and then you get your heels to lift up. So what you want to try and do is teach them to move their knees and hips equally at the same time so you can create that that center mass to maintain as you go down. So we've all seen similar squats like this. One on the left is the good morning squat, right, where you have a whole lot of lumbar flexion, not a lot of knee flexion. They call it a squat. The one in the middle is a split squat where they want to keep all the weight on that posterior leg. They don't want to either translate that knee forward, whether it's pain or ankle tightness. But as you can tell, it's not going to load the quad very well in that position, so you're not going to be able to progress to single leg variations. And then finally, asymmetric squat. So whether that involved leg is not able to sustain that weight, or if they're just commonly shifting over just because that's how they've been practicing getting up and down. So the things that we need to keep our eyes on whenever we go through our squatting programs. So real quick, we're going to go over some basic drills. I want to kind of show you guys some of the things that I go with to get started. This is an ankle wall drill. So basically what I'm trying to do is recreate that anterior knee translation, finding a position that you can use this as a test to determine if they have appropriate amounts of knee and ankle dorsiflexion. But whenever you go through this drill, you can kind of use this as they start to squat. You can say, hey, ankle drill, right? Push your knees towards the wall. That gives them that feedback to remember what they were doing before to add to whenever they start squatting. As far as the weight shift goes, doing a weight, a sit to stand on scales. So she's got bathroom scales under her feet. She's on a mirror, so she doesn't have to stare down at the scales. But what she's trying to do is maintain 50% on the left, 50% on the right. Looking at the mirror allows her to keep her head upright and not stare down at the ground. And then lastly, kind of putting that all together, doing some split squats at the wall. You have that ankle dorsiflexion. You got the knee moving towards the wall. And then what I'm trying to do is maintain him close to the wall so his center of mass is over his base support, right? And then you're teaching him, all right, make sure the knee's going forward, you get the dorsiflexion. When that knee comes back too fast, don't let it come back too fast. Stay over your foot so you're pressing through the floor. That's giving that stimulus and that stress to the proper muscles. This is a progression. Smith press is actually good for something. You can use it to do these PVC split squats. So I have him just putting a little bit of pressure on that PVC. So as he's going down, he's keeping his trunk upright. and he's putting that pressure through that front leg. So we're not getting that posterior weight shift. You're not getting that that common fault. Progressing to a full squat, all right? First off, there is not a standardized depth that we have to follow unless you are in the sport of weightlifting, and then you have to follow the rules that they dictate. But just in general, squatting in general, we need to make sure that the individuals kind of determine the depth versus us, right? So in many cases, no amount of stretching, mashing, releasing will improve that motion. We need to make sure we use the individual's unique articular geometry. All right, so we're doing a passive assessment and an active assessment. In your notes, I have a whole bunch of stuff, information on that. I'm going to go over that during the breakout today. So if you guys want to go over hip mobility and how to kind of go through the squat assessment, that's what I'm going to do in the breakout. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time here talking about it. But typically a passive assessment, you want to see what the ideal range of motion is available to you. And then when you actively assess their hip mobility, you can see how well they control it, how they can move through what they have. So as we get ready to load them, we need to know what's important about loading during a squat. Right, you want to make sure that vertical pass stays over the load, stays over their midfoot. Whenever you place a load on them, depending on where it is on the body, that's going to change their center of mass. So that center of mass is now in a different position. Right, so you need to make sure that center of mass, that plumb line that drops down, is over the middle of their foot. And each different squat variation is going to give you a different amount of knee translation, trunk lean, things that we need to keep in mind when as we start to program these squats for adding load to them. Common myths. So as we get closer and closer, we need to make sure that we're all in agreement on certain things here. Knees going over the toes are bad. We had two guys, Carl Klein, McLaughlin, come up with studies to say knees over toes, not good. Let's squat to parallel. Let's keep them in line. Let's not have any motion occur at the knee. McLaughlin's studies show that if you reduce the amount of knee translation going forward, you can reduce the knee torque by 22%, although it also led to a 1,070% increase in hip and low back torque, so something that wasn't published too well. So we get the knees over toes is bad squats, right? You got people who are squatting with a counterweight just to keep them upright so they don't fall back. You have PowerPoint slides showing people how to squat and land. There's no way you're going to be able to land like that from a jump in the middle. And then you have athletes folding themselves over to keep the bar over their feet so that they can squat. So knees over toes, it's a bad myth. Let's try and get rid of it when we do this. Here's a little study that basically showed parallel lines when squatting. The tibial angle and the trunk angle reduce the torque in the low back and the knee compared to whenever you squat with the trivertical shin. So programming anterior translation, what we should focus on is when the knees move forward past the toes, not if. So as you squat down, as you lower, having the knees go too far forward too soon, you lose that ankle dorsiflexion, your heels come up, we have stresses to the front of the knee. So knowing the program, knowing how to program those different squats, right? The goblet squats have a greater degree of knee flexion, greater degree of anterior translation compared to high bar back squats, low bar back squats, and then box squats. So kind of knowing where the stresses are, where the pain is in the individual, how to reduce those stresses can help you program squatting as you get closer and closer to strength training and hypertrophy. Butt wink and hamstring tightness, hopefully that's an old myth that we can get rid of. A lot of times if you have somebody set up and you see them load and at the bottom of the squat they go through a butt wink or a posterior pelvic tilt, we have that lumbar rounding. A lot of times you can see somebody who's just doing the arch hard, right? They're coming up and they're locking their back and they're just using those lumbar erectors to lock in. And as they go down, you know, Dr. Anderson talked about you're going to have some femoral elastin type of impingement, which is natural to occur at the bottom of a squat. That pelvis has nowhere to go but back. So you're going to see a posterior rotation. So what we want to do is make sure that it's not just the arch hard. We have them go through a supported squat and an unsupported are unloaded just to see if they had the same motion occur. And then possible anatomical limits, right? Shallow hips, sockets, retroverted acetabulums, and femoral necks. Things that you guys can be aware of if you do an assessment. If you know that they're going to have shallow hip sockets at passive motion and they don't have more than 90 degrees of hip flexion before their back starts to round, you can't expect them to be able to squat below that point. Lastly, partial, half, and full range of motion squats, which are better. Partial squats basically train the muscle at the position that you're training. So if you want to get strong at 0 to 40, then you can do squats 0 to 40, and that's going to help you get strong there. And then forces at the ACL and PCL are actually increased at that point, so they actually decrease when we get into more deeper knee flexion angles. Half squats, Escamilla, found that quad activity tends to peak around 80 or 90 degrees. That doesn't mean it shuts off as you get lower. It just means that the higher amounts of activity are going to be at that range. So if you just want to get to that point, or that's all you can get to, you're still getting a good amount of quad activation. And then finally, full squats, right? So going through a full depth, and, you know, typically that's the hip crease below the knees. Full range of motion squats can also increase strength at those partial ranges as well. You get a greater cross-sectional area in the muscle thickness because you're producing more volume of work for that longer distance of work, so you're getting more load through that range. But things that we have to consider, plantar, the patellofemoral joint, compressive forces are near maximum at the bottom of a squat, but also the patellar tendon. The stress there is pretty high as well. Things to consider when we start going into our squatting for volume exercises. So which one's the best one? There's a long list of different squats. I'm not going to go over those today. But which one do we do the best? Which is the best option for our athletes? It's the variation that they can perform optimally. The variation that they can maintain proper form and technique that gives them the best quad activation, gives them the best outcome. And you want to choose that variation based off of the individual's anatomy, biomechanics, and their specific needs and goals. All right, so once again, foot placement. Foot rotation, some coaches might say automatically turn your toes out just when you squat, right? That's not necessary. They've shown that foot rotation during squat shows very little change in muscular activity. But what they did show is as far as stance width, the wider the squat, the narrower the squat, they found that gastroct activity increases with the narrow squat position, which is important because we found at the beginning those ankle pointer flexors are important for those performance characteristics. So in the narrow stance, squats are going to help us with that increased gastroct recruitment. Comparing split squats, front squats, and the rear foot elevated split squat to the back squat, basically all those variations showed similar activation in quad activation to the back squat, which is, you know, your kind of your primary squat variation. So the good thing about split squats, front squats, and the Bulgarian split squat is that the loads can reduce because it's either a single leg variation or it's not in a position to acquire heavy loads. So if you have back pain, if you have somebody who's coming over, maybe has a pars fracture or coming from an injury like that, you can still perform squatting exercises with the load and still provide that stimulus to make the muscles adapt with those variations. And then pause squats and half, 1.5 variations. Spending time at that 89 degrees that we were found to have good quad activation, spending more time in that position is going to give you a good amount of quad activation and good amount of stress and adaptation. All right, so as we load, the whole purpose of loading is to get the muscles stronger, get the muscles bigger. Hypertrophy is an increase in muscle size. Two of the main drivers for muscle hypertrophy, research has shown, has been mechanical loading, the most common stimulus for hypertrophy, and then where the tension disturbs the integrity of the skeletal muscle, we get a higher load, we get higher number of motor units recruited, and then exercise-induced metabolic stress. So that's characterized by a prevention of venous return, a buildup of metabolites inside the muscle, and you get a greater number of repetitions at slower speeds to help get that characteristic. So with those two, you can kind of consider metabolic stress being more volume-related, so in duration. So if you're going to try and work on a more an earlier phase where you're not ready to kind of load them up with an adequate amount of stimulus, doing an early phase of metabolic stress emphasis to get that fatigue more so than your breakdown, which would be a late hypertrophy phase where you're focusing more on the mechanical loading. So a real quick demonstration whenever you're going through fatigue state when you're exercising, you want to make sure that optimal alignment is maintained throughout. So when they fatigue, what are they going to do? They're going to ask other muscle groups to kick in and help out. So you can see with this single leg variation, his weight shift's going back. He's asking his posterior chain to help him out to get up from the bottom. All right, let me see if I can do this right this time. Let's go back here. Let's do it that way. All right, and then when we load, we want to make sure in that late phase, when you're actually loading them, that they are maintaining the load in the right area. So as this guy, as you can see, not a lot of anterior knee shift. His weight, you can see the vertical path of the bar is behind the foot. His weight's typically positioned behind the foot. So he's not truly getting a lot of stimulus, a lot of adaptation to that front side. So we coach him to maintain that center mass forward. We want to keep that weight shifted on that front foot. So when he comes back up, his load's through the front leg. That load doesn't get to shift back. He has to keep his weight forward. That allows him to get the stress that he wants, and that allows us to get the adaptation that we're looking for. Unfortunately, when we break down, when we load, we come across things like patellar tendinopathy. This is a concept and a problem that we could spend an entire time talking about, but we're not going to today, so we're going to just kind of mention it real quick. Typically, patellar tendinopathy is something we'll deal with when we're trying to get our kids back, our athletes back, sudden changes in volume. Good thing is exercise is treatment. So they've shown that high-intensity exercises at or above 70% can be helpful reestablishing that tendon. And then progressive loading, we want to make sure as we go through these programs that we slowly progress them in the load and also in the location. So box squats to low bar to high bar to front squats, the more stress you put on the knee, the more stress you put on the tendon, depending on that anterior knee translation, the more stress you're going to put there. So you want to slowly create that adaptation. And then using accommodating resistance, that's something I've been using a lot more. allowing those bands, if you haven't used it before, allowing those bands to take some stress off at the bottom positions where you have the most stress to the knee and the tendon, allows them to maintain a weight so they get that maybe that top portion of the squat with the true resistance, but at the bottom that resistance is taken off, so it allows them to go through those motions, maintain form and technique, but it protects those sensitive areas, and we want to make sure they recover optimally as well. So here's an example of the bands with the back squat. Nice and slow, he's going all the way down, he comes back up. But at that bottom portion, I've done about 6 or 7 guys. I measured the weight at the top of the squat, and I measured at the weight at the bottom of the squat. It's about 50 to 70 pounds less, depending on their height. But as that band stretches, that poundage reduces. So if it's a 135-pound squat, that potentially is only 65 just so or so at the bottom. So it's a lot less at the bottom. It allows them to go through the motion and keep exercising, keep up their form. So the hypertrophy phase, we want to make sure that muscle increases in size, which has been shown to be a predictor of strength, and then also with patterning and practice, we get an increase in neural drive, which is, you know, where we optimize the coordination of movement to produce the force that we're looking for. And which is neural drive? That's the increase in motor unit recruitment and motor unit firing frequency. And the increase in strength without noticeable hypertrophy is the first line of evidence for neural involvement. We've probably seen those with our athletes. They haven't really gotten any bigger, but they've been able to lift more and more weight. So the practice is, you know, practice makes perfect is better than just going out there and practicing for no reason. So we have strength. This is our first performance characteristic we talked about back in the very beginning. Strength's one of them. It's the ability to produce force, right? High amounts of strength allows us to produce force at high velocities all the way through at the force velocity curve. So what's that, right? We know what the force velocity curve is. What I like about it is just looking at it, it provides a good theoretical basis for the structure and implementation of training. So the goal is, as we get closer and closer to sprinting and jumping, we want to improve that force velocity curve. Right? How we're going to do that, that's what we're going to talk about next. But basically what they show is that the mixed protocols using high velocity training and maximum strength training give us better results than training one or the other. So if you want to increase that force velocity curve, move it to the right. Right? Our goal is to be able to make those athletes more explosive. That's going to be our goal. A study by Bam and Sale suggested that the intended velocity rather than the actual movement velocity is key for creating those velocity-specific adaptations that we're going to shoot for. So just not just having them move quickly, but their intention. So a heavy lift where the velocity is going to be low, their intent to move that as quickly as possible, right, is the goal. So even though you tell them, all right, this is a 90% one rep max, they're going to move that pretty slow, but hopefully their goal with that neural drive is to produce as much speed through that movement as possible. We know strength is specific, and so there's different velocities and loads that they're going to come across during sports, so we want to make sure we address all those velocities with our programming. Maximum strength, we're all pretty familiar with it. It's the big three lifts, back squat, deadlift, bench press, high intensities, low velocities, right? The goal is maximum strength to be able to produce a maximum amount of force with a specific movement. Real quick, I think I have time. This is an example of somebody who's lifting pretty heavy. I want you guys to watch the video, and then we're going to watch it in slow-mo, and you can tell me if you see any change in form. When we're doing maximum strength exercises, ideally you don't want them to load the wrong areas. You don't want them to put themselves in positions where they're going to hurt themselves in those high positions. So if we can go back here, and then here's a slower variation. All right. Tell me what you guys see. Yell it out, or I can say it. Going down slow. Coming back up, right back down. What do you guys see? Anything in particular? What would be something that would cause pain down the road, or if this guy came in complaining of a certain area pain based off of that max rep, what would be an idea position or an idea that might cause him to have that symptom? Anybody want me to say it? Well, so let me see if I can rewind it. So as you can see, what's the difference between that rep right there and the ones you saw before? Anybody see it? No? Yes? The first three, I don't know how to rewind this thing. I wish I knew how to do that. Let me pause it. There we go. I think this is going to work. Watch when he comes up to the top. He's locking out. He's kind of providing a good canister. Everything's in line. Oh, man. Let's see if he... Here we go. All right. First off, you see his belly protrude right there. So he's doing an arch hard. He's coming down. He's got a little bit of butt wink. That's not a big problem. As he comes back up, watch where his hips are positioned. Watch how his back's positioned. See his hips way back behind his spine? He's in this position right here at the top of a squat. So he's got a lot of lumbar flexion. He came in complaining of knee pain and back pain. So those hips aren't getting underneath that load, so he's not optimally stacking his joints when he comes back up from that squat, which potentially can lead to, with stress and repetitive repetition, he's going to load those areas more and more. So basically the idea is we need to watch these athletes under that heavy load and make sure that they're producing optimal positions whenever they carry that. Strength, speed, and speed, strength. right around that power area. These are areas where we're going to start moving light, a little bit lighter weight, really focusing on the intent, the velocity. These areas where we're going to get into Olympic lifts, heavy sled pushes, landmine squat press, so about 80% one rep max. So heavy velocities, but we're still trying to get a little bit faster with our movements. Okay, I like the landmine squat press because it puts them in a position like a lineman where they have to explode, but those 300-pound, 400-pound, you know, not 400-pound, but 300-pound guys in front of them, they're not going to want to move back. So doing a high velocity or a high intent squat exercise where they come down, right? The orientation is similar to what a lineman would produce. So you get that a little bit more horizontal force press. You get that area to come through there. You get him to squat down and then explode from that low position. Speed strength, we're talking a little bit more about jumps, so this is more ballistic training, so lighter resistances, right? A good example here is going to be like your ballistic jump. So ballistics start work on the starting strength ability. So you're coming from a dead stop, right, into an explosive position. So you don't get to utilize the stretch shortening cycle as much, so it's a little bit higher muscle activation when you're doing your box jumps. So a seated box jump, she has to produce a little bit more muscular force to get herself started. Starting strength is important as far as coming back to our sport. We want to make sure that they can start moving with high velocities, high force right from the start. Getting into power. First off, we need to make sure as we produce power, we have a high amount of rate of force development broken down into two phases, the early phase, but also the late phase of strengthening. We can address both of those phases with training. Real quick, I'm going to show this video. I don't have much more time. This is a good example of somebody who's not producing rate of force development through the right area. So he's improperly using the wrong areas. As you see, I told him to squat quickly, right? What he did was he basically utilized his upper trunk. He didn't push through the floor. So that band is pulling up. So if he had pushed through the floor, that band would have stuck to the ground. He did a high amount of lumbar extension and shoulder shrug to squat. So I know from this little test, this little exercise, if he's not producing through the floor, that band's going to pop him up. So it's a good little test you can kind of see as you guys get higher and higher in velocities, making sure they're putting the force in the right areas and not substituting with different muscle groups. The power exercise is closer to a sprint. This guy's working on his 40, right? So get him in a position where he can start in a more horizontal position. It's still a squat variation because he's getting a lot of knee extension, but you're combining it with hip extension as well. You get the hip drive with the opposite leg. Using a calf stretcher incline board, you can get a good amount of stability, and I just have him on some bands and a TRX strap. So that producing that force in a more horizontal direction, which was we found sprinters do, getting that exercise as well. And then lastly, the banded split squat. You guys have probably gone through this one. This is accommodating resistance, so as he gets higher and higher, he's going to have more force. Now, what you guys can you see that posterior shift of his knee? So I didn't cue him at all. Just his natural tendency right off the bat was to produce force and push his weight back. Cueing to stay over his foot, center mass of a base support to make sure he keeps that weight position in the right areas, right? Real important, we watch these techniques. We watch them do it the right way. If they're not doing it, we stop them. We tell them to do it the right way. So we get the adaptations that we're looking for. And eventually we get heavier loads, working our way up in weight. So force time velocity, we're trying to move quick with as much force as possible. Good example of exercises to do. I like meta-analysis because they do all the work. They gather all the research, put it all together. Meta-analysis showed that power cleans and hang cleans at 70% produce peak power. Squats, 30 to 70% load produce the peak power, and jump squats at 30% the one rep max. So if you guys aren't getting those percentages, I know you don't have to stick to a percentile training type method, but it's helpful as far as gauging what load to put on these guys whenever they're doing their exercises. And here's an example of a force velocity curve with those exercises. So if you guys are at that point where you're producing power, you're trying to get the explosiveness back, getting them to hit each one of those, whether it's through a program, if you're going to work on a cycle, if you're going to work on body part splits, whatever you need to do, this is your template would be to get to this point and trying to address it. The mixed training approach has been shown to be better than just focusing on one area or the other.